For some of us, getting a good night's sleep requires an elaborate set of rituals. Screens off, white noise, essential oils perfuming the pillowcase, nice cool room, heavy blanket. There's even a sleep podcast specifically created to bore you to sleep. It is excruciatingly boring and really, really popular. We do these things because sleep makes everything better. It's good for our health, our cognition, even our relationships. But you're not the only one who cares how much you sleep. Your employer might be taking an interest too. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And tomorrow, the Chamber of Commerce is hosting a forum on sleep for the business community. So today, we're going to jumpstart that conversation with people trying to make their work culture more compatible with good sleep habits. We'll start with Sean Yu with us from Garmin. Hi, Sean.
Hi.
So you make wearable devices that can track people's stress levels?
Yes, we do. Yeah, basically we measure people's not only heart rate, but also a phenomenon that's called heart rate variability. And that way we have the way to monitor or to measure people's autonomic nervous system responses. And that's just a very phenomenal behavior that we can tap into people's sleep, and not only sleep, but also their daily activities.
So how does monitoring stress throughout the day help people manage specifically sleep at night?
Basically, if people, well, as we all know, that if we are stressful during the daytime, that may definitely impact our sleep quality. And not only that, maybe a lot of people don't know that the late night coffee or the big snack or even the alcohol at night would affect our stress level. And that would actually appears during our stress level during sleep.
So wait, a snack that I have at night might stress me out?
Maybe. If you have a big snack at night, then that your body needs to digest it. You know, you need to cope with that kind of a big snack, and that may delay your recovery during sleep. But mainly just the effects are from stimulants such as alcohol and caffeine.
So how do people use the information? I mean, how do you use information about your stress, about your sleep, to help you sleep better?
From the genesis of our Garmin's wearable, we have a way to track people's sleep. So we have a way to know that people's onset and termination of the sleep. But moving from there, then we realize that it's not just the sleep duration or deep or light sleep that affects people's quality of life, but also their daily going. And for example, if you have a small children like I do, then probably you didn't really get enough of restful moments at night before sleep, and that would definitely make some impacts to the to your sleep quality, and that would delay a little bit of your sleep or recovery moments during your sleep, and that would show up on your Garmin profile as well.
So how does this work? How does the product itself work, and then how does a customer interact with it?
So right now, Garmin has the best-in-class heart rate monitor. So basically, it's just some gadgets that you wear on your wrist. It's very comfortable, very low profile. And then with this heart rate monitor, we measure heart rate variability, like I said. And that's a high-resolution B2B heart rate. And that way, basically, we just say that, hey, even your heart rate is low. However, we notice some nuances.
So you guys are actually there receiving this data and responding to it.
That's correct. Right. So not only heart rate, but also the device equipped with some motion sensor. So when you toss and turns, this device knows it as well.
And you, like other human beings, know it. So like you know when someone's tossing and turning, you know when someone's maybe getting up to use the restroom in the night. That kind of stuff?
Well, Garmin doesn't really look into individual data like that. So we have a very stringent protection or policy on accessing people's data, real data. So mainly your data is secured and protected, and that data cannot be accessed by any unrelated personnel like me as an engineer. I develop the product, but I don't I mean, I have access to your or any individual's user's data to it.
But someone is using that data for, right?
Someone, mainly the user using that data, yeah.
So, you know, what does this technology do for people? Do you have any, have people been using it long enough to be able to say that they're able to use this data to sleep better? Because the kind of awareness you're talking about, for example, like when I have trouble sleeping, if I look at the clock and see how long I've been awake, that is pretty much the worst thing I can do because that stresses me out. There's nothing I can do about the fact that I've been awake for maybe 2 hours. You know, does knowing help or does it maybe make it worse?
Yeah, you're right. Knowing is actually the first step, right? You cannot really improve something you cannot measure. So our goal is that we provide you information that help you to make a better decision in this wellness domain.
But like the example with small children, what are you going to do about not getting rest in the evening? You can't just be like, I'm not going to take care of my children.
Yeah, that's right. That's a perfect example. But maybe we can just try to make some gradual adjustment to it. However, from the Garmin point of view, we don't really want to like enforce people that you should have this schedule, you should have that schedule. But we provide information, we provide data, so that people can react to it. So it's more like that. So recently, we received a lot of real user report saying that, hey, why my stress is so high even when I was in bed when I'm asleep. Like, hey, I don't really have a restful moment until 3 a.m. What's going on? And then we just say, hey. Did you drink some Red Bulls before bed, or did you use alcohol? And a lot of times that's just the small information or small question like that would just help people to make some adjustment. Even just like, okay,
the
I should cut back.
The alcohol one might be surprising to a lot of people because the general assumption is that that relaxes you.
Yeah, that's exactly. However, alcohol may kind of make you drowsy or make you dizzy, but it's actually not a good way to put you to sleep. It's more like a sedative than an enhancer for your sleep. So, and that would actually reflect it to the person's heart rate and heart rate variability. And that's why we see that, hey, this is a high stress, even when I was in bed, what's going on? And maybe that also explain why when you wake up, you still feel a little bit like insufficient of sleep and you just feel a little bit
maybe
tired.
Maybe hungover.
Exactly. If you have too much, then maybe that's the hungover.
How are your sleep habits?
I have to admit that my sleep habit is not that good. I'm in the same camp with small children at home, but not only that, I'm actually competing with some other things, effects such as keeping up with of my work and also Netflix. So, yeah,
is that two things you must keep up with.
Exactly,
work and
the show that I have. So I have to admit that I have to put some sweat in my sleep hygiene. I have to make sleep as my priority.
Sleep is supposed to be relaxing, not like a labor of, you know, like I got to put some sweat into this.
Exactly. But to be honest, that some people may think that, yeah, my schedule is flexible, but the truth is that they actually sacrifice sleep to make their schedule flexible. And in order to have a better sleep, we should have a very rigorous, I shouldn't say religious, schedule for sleep. And that would just give you at least 7 to 9 hours of good quality of sleep. And that will help you to get a new day better.
But why don't you do that? I mean, you're this person who has like more data than anyone could imagine on this. There has to be something about that Netflix show that is of value to you, or something about your work schedule that just won't budge.
I actually started doing that. I try to keep a better sleep hygiene since I working on the project related to sleep and we improve or enhance our current sleep features on our wearables. That's just helped me to be more aware, especially after listening to a lot of stories from our users, that like testimonies of how our products will help them to get better sleep. Now I'm keeping up. But it's not like a night and day change. Sleep is just like you mentioned, Gina, that you cannot say that, hey, I want to fall asleep and just boom, and then you fall asleep.
Yeah,
right
that
away.
Would be nice.
Exactly. That would be nice, right? But nobody could do that, right? So it has to be has some sort of like a gradual change. And I try to increase my sleep amount gradually, day by day, something like that.
But it is ironic that, you know, when you talk about your work keeping you up in particular, when your work is helping people sleep. I mean, at Garmin, are there interventions for employees and their sleep? I mean, this is a company watching all kinds of people sleep. What about employees?
Right. I cannot answer this question better than my colleague, who is the senior well-being.
We'll be talking to her
specialist.
In a second, but I'm curious
right.
about your answer.
Right. To be honest, it's actually spontaneous. I don't really receive a lot of emails from my colleagues, from my supervisors. My managers don't send me emails at night. So we actually very emphasize the work-life balance at Garmin.
Is there an actual rule about no emails at night?
Well, we don't have the like a written rule say no emails at night, but one thing that I appreciate is that as a time extended employee at Garmin, we have a flexible hours. So it's like plus minus 1 hour from 8 to 5. If I go to work at 7 a.m., I can leave for work for 4. If that day I feel particularly drowsy, I may be able to walk into my office at night, but I just need to leave for home a little bit later. So that's something I appreciate Garmin has. That's a great policy to help me to catch up some sleep when I need it.
That's really cool. Let's talk to Haley Profit about this. She's the senior well-being specialist at Garmin. Hi, Haley.
Hi.
How much does your company think that workers' sleep patterns matter to the success of the business?
We absolutely know it's important. We know that it isn't just a business case. It, you know, we can directly tie it to productivity and performance. We know that they're going to be better performers when they're more cognitively restful when they come in. But it's also kind of the bigger picture on, just as John had mentioned, this work-life integration concept. You know, we don't have a written policy that emails can't happen past 8, 10 p.m. But people are very respectful of that. We want to give them that space so that they can make that choice for themselves. And hopefully they're creating those healthy sleep patterns
at home.
But
is someone there saying, actively encouraging people to stop working after a certain time?
You know, I think it's going to be very dependent on the business segment that they're representing as well, because we are an international company. And so we do have various times to consider. We have various industries that we're serving and representing. So we're very cognizant of that. But I would also say throughout all of our companies and all of our locations that it's also about the education and awareness and knowing that the leaders that we do have in the organization do care about their people enough to say your health and well-being is a priority.
You know, you mentioned having offices all over the world in different time zones. I wonder if office cultures differ in terms of how they accommodate or encourage sleep.
Absolutely. You know, a prime example is we have multiple locations in Taiwan, and many businesses there, including the Garmin locations, have sleeping decks. They have sleeping rooms. They have lots of opportunities for those individuals to go take restful times throughout their day. I think that it's definitely
like
a cultural block
a
here. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's going to be a slow shift that we start seeing in the Americas, but it's going to be coming. This is a trend. Sleep is important to employers. We're starting to be able to make that correlation directly. So while a napping room isn't something that we do have on site right now in the United States, especially at headquarters, we are creeping down the path of, you know, we have meditation rooms and we have other quiet spaces for our associates to go when they are on site. And again, are we providing them enough opportunities and education so that when they're at home, they're also taking their own responsibility and saying, hey, sleep's a priority to me.
Is this when you take initiatives like meditation rooms? I mean, as you talk about creeping towards stuff like napping rooms, is that something that you have to sell people on from a business standpoint?
Yeah. I'm going to say yes. When you're going into a corporate setting, especially, sometimes those conversations are going to be a little tough, a little odd for some cultures, but there's also going to be others that are right on board immediately, and that's okay too. Even if you are trying to sell it in certain cultural situations, it's a progressive thing. And so it's not going to be something that happens immediately overnight. It's going to be, what are baby steps that we can do to get to a place like that?
Well, this is really fascinating. Haley Prophet is with us from Garmin. We've also been talking with Sean Yu, who's a product designer there who measures other people's sleep while sleeping badly himself. And we're going to pick right back up with this discussion with a sleep doctor. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Today we're talking about sleep and the workplace. The Kansas City Chamber of Commerce is hosting a forum on sleep because it's something businesses are taking an interest in. Does the culture where you work affect your sleep? Call 816-235-2888 to weigh in. 816-235-2888. Dr. Jason Graff is here now. He's the Medical Director of Sleep Disorders at St. Luke's Hospital System. Hi, Jason.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So we all probably have this intuitive sense that getting a good night's sleep improves our functioning, but what do we know about how sleep really affects our lives, like when we're awake?
It's really individualized, and the short answer is that the duration and quality of sleep that you need is enough for you to feel rested and alert throughout the day, not fall asleep when bored for 5 minutes or when you sit down on the couch or watch your favorite TV show. So that is one topic of debate, in that a lot of people are fixated on getting 8 hours of sleep but may feel completely rested after 6 or 7.
But maybe they don't know what really rested is.
Right.
like if they've always been chronically undersleeping.
Right. Two-thirds of Americans report getting insufficient sleep during the work week. And chronic sleep insufficiency often leads to sort of an insidious onset of problems that become chronic, and that person may think that I'm getting older, this is how I'm supposed to feel at this age. You know, I get up multiple times a night for my kids, I'm not supposed to feel rested. But how you feel may not actually be as good as you can feel if you had better sleep.
So, you know, I read in the New York Times that Americans on the whole are getting about 18 minutes more sleep a night than we used to about 10 years ago. That's not very much, 18 minutes. But, I mean, they say that that's coming from the time we save making purchases online, possibly, instead of running errands, like that we're not watching less TV or doing, you know, like we're not, it's not an active sacrifice of something that we are deliberately making. Do we fail to, like, recognize how important this is?
I think in general, we have failed at that, but awareness is increasing. You know, the colleagues we've already spoken with, you know, point to the trend of large corporations recognizing how sleepy employees are less productive, they're more prone to accidents. And depending on the business, it's hard to quantify, but one estimate that I read was that more than $63 billion is lost each year because of mistakes made and poor productivity by employees that were sleep deprived.
What is your sense of how people's work environments can either help or make things worse?
As Haley was kind of mentioning with Garmin, some of those initiatives have to come from the top down. If your boss is constantly sending you emails and asking you to do stuff at 3 a.m., that sends a culture that everyone has to be ready to work on a 24-hour cycle, and that your individual sleep isn't important. So at least from a corporate wellness point of view, that's a culture that has to be created from the top down. But I think individually, as more and more of our work becomes portable, you can take your work home on your handheld device or your computer. In my experience, it becomes harder and harder to set the boundary of when the bell rings at 5 and I go home, work is done and I do whatever I want. I take care of my family. I exercise. As a physician, we are pushed more and more to be productive. You know, there's a physician shortage. We have to see more and more patients. And we often take our charting and our computer work and we do it at home. And sometimes that bleeds into time when we would normally realize we should be sleeping.
Yeah, you know, that is an interesting issue. I mean, you are a sleep specialist, but you work in a field. I mean, hospitals are notorious for being really disruptive to employees' sleep schedules.
Right. We have to staff a hospital 24/7, and many of our personnel that work at night, when they're not working, there's a lot of stuff they have to do during the day. They shift back to a day schedule. They have to get their kids to school. Yet when their night shift comes up, they stay up all night and are probably less productive than they would be if they had a regular sleep schedule. So finding the fine balance with having to, you know, providing a good service yet having rested employees that do quality of work is often difficult.
Yeah, I mean, is there an initiative like that to work on that at St. Luke's? Because, I mean, it does seem like a hospital is limited in what they can do. Patients do need care 24 hours a day. That's just the reality. But what kinds of steps can hospitals take?
Well, I've been at the St. Luke's Health System long enough to see some of the progress. You know, part of our wellness criteria in order to get discounts on our health insurance premiums involve getting enough sleep. Now, how much is enough? That kind of depends on the person, but it's becoming increasingly recognized.
Wait, you can just say I got enough sleep and that's enough, though?
Right. So it's sort of self-reported. It's not yet monitored. Someday maybe Sean and our Garmin colleagues will help us with that.
Yeah. I mean, that does raise some interesting ethical questions. But I mean, assuming that it's with the employee's best interest in mind, what else? I mean, what other than those like health insurance discounts for people who are doing healthy things like sleeping enough at night by their own reports?
I think these initiatives are still in their infancy. I think that we're still in the process of raising awareness of how important sleep is for the, for the common American. We have more and more technology available to where you can get some more objective feedback on how you sleep, whether or not you're getting enough sleep. A lot of people, even though they will self-report that they're not getting enough sleep, objectively, they're getting even less than they think they're getting.
Wait, that's terrible.
Right. But I have to see patients all the time. They come in, they say they go to bed at a certain time, but they don't count that they're in bed, they check their email on the phone, notifications pop up, they check a couple more things, and they check the weather the next day, and they're actually falling asleep much later than they perceive. And sometimes they're shocked at the data that comes from their smart device or their sleep tracker software that shows that maybe they're not sleeping as well as they thought they were.
So what's your advice? I mean, do you have some just quick advice that people can take to heart? If their employers are not giving them some helpful things, what can we do to help ourselves?
Well, I think you have to be aware of a lot of the negative consequences of chronically being sleep deprived. And it's not just about your productivity at the workplace, although it has been shown that the sleepy employee is less likely to be productive and less likely to advance in companies. But you really have to look at some of the data, and that chronic sleep deprivation can increase your risk of cardiovascular disease. It reduces quality of life. It makes people more irritable. It can negatively affect all of your interpersonal relationships at home and at work.
But I have to tell you something. You are really stressing me out telling me these things. And I feel like I love sleep. I know sleep matters. And I still sometimes have trouble sleeping. And hearing all these things like, God, it's affecting my relationships. And like, it makes me feel really stressed out, which I don't think it is helpful.
Mm-hmm.
To know how bad it is.
And that's the debate I sometimes have with my patients. They'll come in and they'll bring in sleep tracker data, and there'll be a lot of lines that suggest that they are not sleeping as deeply as they want to sleep. It starts with how you feel during the day. If you feel great during the day and you're not sleepy, then little bursts or periods of what your sleep tracker thinks is not restful sleep probably isn't clinically significant. if you feel tired during the day and are not rested, and you want further, you want to be able to monitor that yourself, then these devices can be very helpful. The difficult part is, how does the common consumer interpret that data, and what does it mean? Just like when Sean was speaking earlier, there are many medications, there are substances that you can take in, like caffeine or alcohol, that can affect the architecture of sleep and alter sleep tracking data. But ultimately, you need to make sleep a priority. It's really easy to think that you can compensate for poor sleep with caffeine, or I'm going to get a nap later, which may or may not really come to fruition.
If a nap does come to fruition, is that helpful, or does it not matter if it's not part of like the big chunk of sleep at night?
It can be helpful. A short nap in somebody who's chronically sleep deprived can be very refreshing. You just don't want to sleep so much during the day that it interferes with your ability to fall asleep later that night.
You know, I want to get back to sort of how the way we structure our work lives plays into all of this. Haley, you know, for me, this is just as disrupted as my sleep has ever been by a job. I used to work at a coffee shop where some days of the week I did the early morning opening shift, which started at about 5:30 in the morning. And then there were other days of the week when I did the closing shift and didn't finish till like 11 at night. And it wasn't that one was so early I couldn't have done it, or the other was so late that it was a problem, but having my schedule all over the map like that was a real sleep disaster. And I don't know if there's any like medical information behind why we can't just sleep whenever we feel like it. I mean,
there is. The circadian rhythm, or our internal biologic clock, wants us to sleep when it's dark and be awake when it's light, as if we were living like cavemen. We just have work duties, family duties,
and
artificial lighting that allow us to fight against our own biology. And it's when we do that frequently at irregular intervals where we can feel even more sleep deprived depending on the time of day and what we're doing.
So Haley, like, scheduling seems like it would be a big part of this.
Yeah. So one thing that I really like to talk about, and I utilize the opportunity anytime at Garmin in classes we host and programs we have going on, is talking about a bedtime routine for adults. And it sounds so silly, but adults actually need it way more than kids. Kids are going to fall asleep. They're going to stay asleep, you know, for the most part. But adults take complete advantage of, we do have electronics, we have tablets, we have phones, we have computers, we have TVs, we have all of this around us all the time. We have these lights on all the time. You know, really talking about the shade of the lighting in the house. You know, are they dimming it? Are they reducing their screen time? Are they not consuming the alcohol? Are they incorporating workouts throughout the day that are the best time for them and their bodies? And are we really creating that bedtime routine? And so it's simplifying things enough so that they understand we've got to create an environment that's going to be conducive to sleep, so that we're not laying there, just as you mentioned, watching the time tick by and stressing over not falling asleep. Instead, have we prepared ourselves for sleep?
And does that start like at a point in the day when people are still at work at Garmin? Like when you talk about getting in a workout at the time that's best for your body, is it, do employees at Garmin have that freedom to say, the best time for my body to work out is 2. So sorry, meeting that happens at 2.
Right. Yeah. Honestly, yes. Sometimes that is this case and scenario. But I would say for the most part, we're very cognizant of, we do have jobs and jobs that we probably want to keep. So we know meetings are important. I will say that, again, it goes back to this culture conversation. Sleep is important. Workouts are important. Taking care of our own well-being is really a priority. So how do we make that work? How do we integrate that into our daily life and make it easy for us? The last thing we want to say, just as you had mentioned, is being stressed over this. We shouldn't be stressed about taking care of ourselves. It should just naturally be a priority.
What are the challenges to that in a corporate environment, even one where people have been sold on exactly the message you're stating? Because I think most human beings can hear what you're saying and say, yeah, that's how it should be. But there might be some really like immovable obstacles to that in terms of a company's bottom line.
Sure, absolutely. And I don't think we have time today to go into the millions of challenges that exist in every corporate environment. But that's also, you know, more broad spectrum. Every business, every organization is going to experience those. I think it's really looking at well-being in such a holistic manner that, again, it does need to fit naturally into your lifestyle, into your daily routine, whether it's raising kids, it's going to work, it's, you know, preparing your food. It is finding time throughout the day for the workout, but also not stressing ourselves out about it. You know, if you have the one cheeseburger, if you get a few hours less sleep one night, but you're building relationships, you had an event and you were with friends, you have to really look at it in that broader spectrum of what am I doing for myself and is this really going to impact me in meaningful long-term ways that are helping my well-being.
You know, Sean, when you look at people's data, when you look at data in general, do the things that Haley's describing, like building relationships and things like that, do they play into an overall picture of how healthy and relatively stress-free a person is?
First of all, I have to say that the way we measure stress is actually the physiological stress. It's actually an integrated stress that combines emotional, psychological, and also physical stress. So we heard about this recommendation saying that, hey, you shouldn't exercise too close to your bedtime. That's because your body needs to cope with the aftermath of that. Second of all is that our wearable actually measure a lot of things, but we don't really have a lot of contextual information. We don't ask people about their personal life. We don't tap into that, hey, what did you do in the evening that makes you that, until a user spontaneously asks us about that. And to answer your question, that our big data team actually look into the metadata, which is totally depersonalized data, and then we just come up with some suggestion in general for a particular user based on the bigger user base. And again, that's just the data. We don't really say that, hey, this is something you should follow. We just say that, hey, in general, the average American get 8 hours of sleep, and now you're falling on the spectrum of this. Then you can do something about this.
But, like, do you have data on whether, like, in terms of what triggers the physiological stress and what calms it? Like, is you know, Haley saying going out with friends and sacrificing that sleep might be a wash. Maybe that was worth it, even physically, in terms of your health.
I agree.
Does the data support that?
I agree. Yeah, yes. Because the stress that showed up is not the general perceived stress. It could be like excitement, and that would actually boost your energy up a little bit. And it's not just this instantaneous one that we look at. We have to look at, just like Haley said, we have to look at the bigger picture, because if the stress doesn't really last for a long period of time, that may not give you any of detrimental impact to your health, because that could just be because, hey, you need this excitement, you need this kind of boost for your social life, for your psychological aspect, to take care of self and also your family, and that wouldn't as far as I know, that wouldn't impact your sleep at night if that's just short bursts of the excitement moments.
You know, one last question for our doctor here. I mean, when we talk about what a work culture can do to help us sleep, in a perfect world, our bosses care how we sleep. They care about our well-being. And some people are lucky enough to be in that situation. Others are not. And sometimes your only advocate for your own well-being is you. And you were talking about how hard it is to, you know, go ahead and turn off the phone, even though you might have someone emailing you in the middle of the night with the expectation and a work culture that you're maybe going to answer that. How do you set your own limits? I mean, do you advise your patients on these things?
I do all the time, especially my patients that come in fatigued or have insomnia, that, you know, you just have to make sleep a priority. And you know, part of what Sean was talking about, how he knows all the good sleep habits and admits that he doesn't follow them all the time, because we have families, we have multiple things pulling us in every direction. And you just have to create healthy habits. And sometimes your employer will encourage that and sometimes they won't. But I think that times are changing. We know more and more about the negative consequences of poor sleep, you know, especially in over-the-road truck drivers or pilots, sort of mission-critical type of workers. But that sort of low productivity can affect anybody's workplace.
Jason Graff, thank you for joining us from St. Luke's.
Thank you.
And Haley Prophet, Sean Yu with us from Garmin. This has been fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And now, goodbye, healthy habits. Hello, candy. It's Valentine's Day. We'll get the history of candy after this break on KCUR's Central Standard. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. From Vallow Milk to Russell Stover and now Christopher Elbow, Kansas City has earned a place on the map of American candy, if there was such a map, and I think there should be. It's Valentine's Day, and we're about to dive into the weirdly fascinating history of candy in the U.S. But first, let's stop by a few Kansas City candy shops to hear about the nostalgic treats people come and buy.
My name is Corey. I am a manager at the New Dime Store in Brookside, Kansas City. It is a little bit of everything store. It's a nostalgia thing. It brings them back to their childhood. A lot of the customers in here have actually been customers since they were children. So they remember coming in with grandma and grandpa 30, 40, 50 years ago and walking these same wooden floors and getting their same vintage fun candies. Other classic candies are going to be like our Turkish taffies, which are designed to be beaten and broken apart. You don't bite into it. Don't do it. We've got our Pop Rocks, which are always a good seller. Kids especially just enjoy Pop Rocks, especially a lot of kids have not had Pop Rocks. Chico Sticks are probably going to be my top sellers. I have those in a couple different forms. I have the large stick style one, and then I have a small 10-cent one as well.
I'm Jasmine. We're a chips candy factory at Crown Center. The ones that are the ones they come in here for the most, it will be the root beer barrels here. And then if you come around on this side, we have the Chico Sticks and the peanut butter bars and Mary Jane's and like the Biddle Honeys and the Kits. Normally older customers. And they do ask for black licorice. We have a lot of that.
I love old-timey candy. Especially like those candy cigarettes. I used to get those when I was a kid. I do buy them now for myself. I think it was just because my mom and dad were big smokers that I felt kind of cool that I had them. I don't think that they tasted very good. It was just the appeal of how they looked.
My name is Edward Proshak. And I am from Ukraine. This is European delights. We have candy, more candy from Russia, Ukrainian, Polish. This all Eastern European style. All nationality popular, and all people have own taste. For example, Polish people prefer Polish candy. Ukrainian people prefer Ukrainian people. Yeah, this reminds home. And American people like everything. They take Russian, Ukrainian, and Polish, everything.
KCUR's Laura Ziegler and our intern Matt Groby took us on that candy shop tour of Kansas City. Afterwards, Laura gave Matt a taste test. She had him try one of our iconic candies, the Cherry Mash, made in St. Joe, because Cherry Mash is celebrating its 100th birthday. And you know, a candy that stood the test of time an entire century? That's impressive. But we couldn't help wondering if these candies from 1918 would really hold up to current tastes. So here we go. Let's see what Matt thinks.
Opening it up. It's like a little ball of chocolate with some nuts on top. All right.
I'll tell you what it is. Do you want to know what it is before
yes,
you eat it?
Yes, I would like to know.
It's mashed maraschino cherries.
Okay.
Covered in chocolate with crushed peanuts.
All right.
Okay, he's tasting it now.
It's like a mush puree, almost. Is that the best way to describe that? Okay. It's good. I'd buy it. Yeah.
Hmm. I'll take your word for it. I'll tell you what I like about cherry mesh is what it looks like. It is so old-timey and nostalgic. I just love that this candy is still being made and sold after 100 years, surviving changes in taste and marketing strategy, even the Great Depression. And that is part of the larger story of candy in the U.S. For that story, I'd like to welcome Susan Benjamin, author of the book Sweet as Sin. She also runs a nostalgic candy shop of her own. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
What got you interested in the history of candy?
Well, I'd been a researcher, college professor, all sorts of things, and someone just happened to ask me a question about candy, and just because it was my instinct, I started researching it, and there I found the most amazing untold history of how North America and then the United States came to be what it is today.
Candy has something to do with who we are today?
Well, candy really does. It came out of the medicines. It came out of the tradition of using sugar for a whole number of things and was in part...
To help the medicine go down.
Well, part of the reason for enslavement, for example, and the changing terrain of the Native Americans and the reason for the American Revolution.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
Candy, explain this.
Thank you. I will. Candy became candy as we know it today in the mid-1800s. But previous to that, people had been using it for different things. So it's been around since the beginning of U.S., or I should say North American history.
What? So, you know, it's... Do I understand right that it's in the 1800s that they start marketing candy to children?
That's exactly right. With Industrial Revolution and the ability to make interesting things came marketing. And one of the target group was, in fact, not only children, but children of the working class, or as they were described, the lower class children.
What, so give me the picture of what that looked like and how it changed our culture.
Thank you. Yeah, it was really amazing. It changed our culture in so many ways, but it was a time of huge change anyway. But I would single out the one most significant issue was that candy was inexpensive. It was, as I said, marketed to kids. And this was the first time in U.S. history that the children of the working class were able to enter the middle class by purchasing candy. And it was a big deal. It was a huge shift for them.
So having candy was a status symbol?
Not so much a status symbol. It may have been depending on the candy, but that was mainly reserved for the well-to-do. But it was a power symbol. You could go in and you could do something with your money. You could have purchasing power.
And so candy was inexpensive enough that it was not only marketed to children, but that children without a lot of means could still access it?
Exactly. And the well-to-do hated that. And they blamed candy on everything from the polio epidemic to murders to fires. They said it would lead them to take on alcohol abuse. It was really crazy. And today, that is the reason why we think of candy as a lower form or something that's really, really bad for us and all those other guilt-associated feelings.
So, I mean, those guilt feelings don't have anything to do with actually candy not being good for you?
Candy is a multi-billion-dollar industry, but in fact, we get approximately, it's hard to know for sure, but approximately 6% maybe of our sugar and around 3, 4%, maybe 5% at most of our calories.
Even people who eat lots of candy?
People know how to monitor candy, but what you want to think about is if that little amount is from candy, what else are we eating that gives us all that ridiculously huge volume of sugar in our diet?
So candy has been vilified since the 19th century. Has there been a golden age of candy in America?
There sure was. And you see that with the cherry mash. The golden age really came about during Prohibition. because the restaurants couldn't serve cocktails anymore. So they started serving candy, particularly the really enrobed chocolatey kind of candy. But it was a really great time for candy lovers. And it took on just wonderful turns of events. It was really kind of cool.
Describe it a little more to me. I mean, what are some of the candies we saw during the Golden Age, and just what was candy manufacturing and variety like?
Yeah, candy manufacturing was pretty sophisticated by then. You had big factories and so on. But there was this real interplay between what was happening at the time with Prohibition and the candies themselves. So may I talk about the cherry mash since
yes,
it's your
please.
Very own? The cherry mash was actually originally, it was called a number of things, but the cherry chaser. And that is because it was the Chase Company, possibly. But it morphed into the Cherry Chaser, which was a drink, an alcoholic beverage, as well as a soda pop. And that became the Cherry Mash with the same, it was the same thing. It was considered a booze, and it was considered a candy, and it was considered a soda, all of those things. So it really gave the Cherry Mash a great footing in what was happening nationally and all of the scuttlebutt about Prohibition and
so people
drinking.
Who couldn't have their favorite drinks maybe would go and find a candy that was sort of maybe even deliberately marketing a connection with one of those drinks.
I think it was more cultural. You're absolutely right. It was a marketing to the existence of Prohibition. But I am more likely to believe they went to the speakeasies and knowing they were fun and had this aura of festivity, the candy companies named their candy for the event of the speakeasies and the drinks there.
You know, right now, something like craft beer is enjoying, you know, maybe a golden age. And people not only enjoy, you know, sampling all the different kinds or going to places that make them, but also trying to make it themselves. Did the golden age of candy look like that? I mean, was the ordinary American like deeply invested in how candy was made?
They were invested in making it themselves because you have to remember, early on, candy came from the apothecaries where the sugar was, and that was where people got it, at the apothecaries, and then at home. And some of the forgotten candy makers, the wonderful forgotten candy makers, were the mothers and the homemakers and so forth who made that for their children and their families. So it definitely had a presence in the home, but not in the same way as the craft beer. It was more, I don't know how to put it, more heart to heart, a gift of love and care.
You know, this is going to sound really weird, but I read Alec Baldwin's memoir, and in it he talks about how, you know, his grandparents giving him candy, and he just sort of tossed in this thought about that people used to show their love to children with sweets, and that now we show our love by withholding them. And I thought, wow, that's an interesting observation.
It is a wonderful observation. So during the sugar shortages of the wars and the Depression and so forth, people hungered for sugar. They really wanted it. And when those times were over, all of a sudden there's all the sugar. And they found themselves in the hard candies, for example, that grandmothers carried in the purses, and the Necco wafers. So in giving those candies, as Baldwin said, in giving those candies, it was a gift of comfort, of love. They were still attached to them as medicines, as they had been, say, for sore throat, and saying everything's okay. Sugar is back and everything's okay. And people today, I'm sure so many people who are listening at this moment, remember the candy bowls and purses of their childhoods.
Well, and on Valentine's Day, we still give candy as a symbol of love.
Yes, we do.
Well, our time is up, but Susan Benjamin, thanks so much. What kind of candy do you want to eat on Valentine's Day? Do you have a special one?
Oh, you're kidding. I've been working my way into it all week. The cinnamon hearts and the jelly candies. Oh, boy, you name it. I love it.
Thank you so much, and happy Valentine's Day.
And you.
Susan's the author of Sweet as Sin. She also runs True Treat Historic Candy in West Virginia. And that's a wrap. You can listen back to this morning's discussions at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have them ready for you by the end of the day, probably a lot sooner. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, the stories behind quilts made by local refugees, plus looking back on 5 years of Folk Alliance International in Kansas City. Has it made a difference for the city's musicians? Join that discussion tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with lots of help from intern Matt Groby, who tasted the cherry mash. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.